we know that shifting to a new form of taxation would be a step in the right direction and would overcome the fact that if you make your family care work in a way that doesn't engage an outside provider, you're being penalized for that choice, which arguably is just insane. It doesn't make any sense.
On the feature interview today, a look at the notion of income splitting. What are the chances it'll be implemented in the next federal budget? On the news portion, there's a new evangelical initiative on climate change policy. Justin Trudeau puts his foot in it again on the abortion question. And a new study on the benefits of private Christian schools to provincial education budgets across the country.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
You may recall that on the last edition of Lighthouse News, we featured an interview with Dr. Ross McKittrick on the issue of climate change policy. Following up on that, there's a new evangelical initiative being spearheaded by the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. The Alliance has just published a new study entitled Protect the Poor, 10 Reasons to Oppose Harmful Climate Change Policies. The study was co-authored by a professor from the University of Victoria, and the Alliance has it up on the web with an invitation for you to endorse its contents. The Alliance is led by Dr. Calvin Beisner, and I caught up with him by phone in an airport lobby in Charlotte, North Carolina.
The effort to fight global warming by reducing carbon dioxide emissions is bound to lead to much higher energy prices. And that hurts everybody, but it hurts the poor worst of all, because the poor spend a higher percentage of their incomes on energy than do other folks. So the result of that is kind of like a regressive tax. Folks in industrialized countries, average folks, it's an inconvenience. It's not nice, but most of us can handle it. But in developing countries, the idea that we're going to tell them that they have to forgo the use of fossil fuels, coal and natural gas for making electricity, oil for transportation fuel, for a long period because they can't afford to go directly to the much more expensive wind, solar, and other so-called green energy sources. To tell them that is just, I think, unconscionable, because it means condemning them to more generations of abject poverty and the high rates of disease and premature death that always come with it.
You've got some stuff up on your website, and you're inviting support. You've got about 150 people signed up so far, but you're asking people to support the position.
Folks can go to cornwallalliance.org. That's cornwallalliance.org. And the new declaration, Protect the Poor, 10 Reasons to Oppose Harmful Climate Change Policies, is there on our homepage. They can read the declaration. If they want to read the supporting research paper, about a 55-page research paper by two really outstanding scholars, climate scholars. One is Dr. David LeGates, a climatologist at the University of Delaware, and the other is a Canadian, Dr. G. Cornelis Van Kooten, who is a professor and Canada chair of research in environment and climate. They can read that paper there as well, and we would ask them to go ahead and endorse the declaration. There's a form right there on the page that has the declaration. They can fill that out. The aim is to get as many signatures as possible to show that, yeah, there are an awful lot of Christians who embrace this thinking, and that simply helps to show policymakers where the people want them to go.
The initiative has already been featured in World Magazine and the Christian Post. We've got links to the policy paper and some of the other news coverage on our website. In other news, Justin Trudeau's militant anti-life position came to the fore again earlier this month when a group of seven former Liberal members of Parliament signed an open letter to their new leader, criticizing his insistence that all candidates for the party have to be expressly pro-choice if they want the Liberals' endorsement to run. We Need a Law's Mike Schutten says the letter had two main points.
One was just, first of all, a deep concern for the fact that Justin Trudeau wouldn't allow any pro-life MPs to run in the Liberal Party anymore since his edict earlier this year. But the second one is kind of interesting. They brought in this notion of almost a fear of dictatorial-style leadership. And they said this is not the Liberal Party that we served for. These MPs collectively served more than seven decades under the Liberal Party. And they said this is not the party that we know, where leaders are going to dictate moral perspectives from individual candidates, individual MPs. So, yeah, we're pretty excited about the fact that these MPs have taken a stand and that this continues to be an issue that's going to follow Justin Trudeau, hopefully right through till the fall 2015 election campaign.
It didn't take Justin Trudeau long to respond to the letter. On the afternoon of the day it was released to the media, he issued a tweet. Let me quote what he wrote. "The days when old men get to decide what a woman does with her body are long gone. Times have changed for the better. LPC, that would be the Liberal Party of Canada, defends rights." That response getting quite a bit of pushback. Writing in the National Post, Kelly McFarland essentially made the case that it's silly to connect a politician's authority to write legislation to the relationship between their gender and the issue they're legislating. Mike Schutten says that's one of the flaws in Trudeau's response. The other is purely political.
That tweet just shows actually the arrogance of Mr. Trudeau. First of all, old men have no say, but him as a middle-aged man, they do have a say. Secondly, if I was a senior in Canada, I would be taking great offense to a statement like that. We're supposed to look to our seniors for wisdom, for clarity on issues that they have gone through before. And here he's just dismissing them like a bunch of old men. It's arrogant, it's disrespectful, and I hope Canadians see it for what it is.
We link to various commentaries on the controversy on our website. And finally, what impact does the existence of private, Christian, or parochial schools have on education budgets in this country? During the BC teacher strike, which just wrapped up, the provincial government in Victoria was roundly criticized by the teachers' union for, quote, subsidizing private schools. Mark Milkey from the Fraser Institute took on that notion in a column that ran in a number of newspapers earlier this month. The bottom line, he says, is that some people seem to have a pretty funny definition of the word subsidy.
The working definition I'm using from Merriam-Webster is very simple. Government purchases of goods or services at prices above the market price. Well, when governments purchase an education from private schools, what are they doing? They're purchasing a service at below the market price. So depending on the province, they're getting a heck of a deal because they're paying 30-50% in British Columbia, 35-50% rather. In other provinces, it ranges as much as an 80% discount or 100% discount because governments aren't paying for private schools at all. My main point, private schools are saving taxpayers money because they're not funded to the same extent as public schools on a per-student basis.
In Ontario, for example, he says there's more than 100,000 students in private, Christian, Catholic, and Jewish schools.
If you took those kids and put them in the public school system, the Ontario Auditor General said that would be an extra $1 billion. And he said that means you'd either have to pay an extra $1 billion or you'd have to divert $1 billion from somewhere else in the education system to pay for those students. So regardless of what you want to call what governments do with private schools, if you want to call it a subsidy or if you want to call it a purchase of a service at a discount rate, the end point is still the same. You're saving money by having kids in the private school system instead of the public school system.
We link to the column he wrote on our website this week. More after this.
The ARPA Canada website has been updated to include online versions of our publications. Go to arpacanada.ca/publications to read more than 25 policy reports, lesson plans, and books written by ARPA Canada. You can read them online, share them with your friends via email or social media, or print your own copy. ARPA Canada's mission is, in part, to educate, equip, and encourage Reformed Christians to political action. And we hope this new feature on our website will do just that.
And we're back. On the line with me today from Ottawa is Andrea Morozik. She's the Executive Director of the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada. Andrea, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
We're talking this morning about the notion of income splitting. It's something that was promised by the federal conservatives in the last campaign, and now there's some question about whether or not it's going to go ahead. First of all, Andrea, let's talk a little bit about defining the concept. What is income splitting and how does it work?
Income splitting is probably a title that misrepresents what this is. Essentially, we're talking about a tax cut for families. Family taxation or family income splitting, whatever you call it, what it means is that two parents can split their income if they are in different tax brackets. They can share their income, spread it out between each other so that they lower their tax burden. Places one of the parents in a lower tax bracket and you pay less tax. There's a number of different models across the globe for this. One of them in France, for example, allows a single parent to split with children, thereby ensuring that people who don't have a traditional family format are also included. Two-parent homes in France can split with a number of children, so the more children you have, the more you could spread your income out and the more tax money you could save. Essentially, when your listeners hear the term income splitting or family taxation, they ought to be thinking about a tax cut for parents who are raising kids, and that's indeed what we're talking about here.
There's been a lot of criticism of this concept, especially lately. The main one we hear is that really this only benefits so-called wealthy families. How true is this? You've just done a study. Analyze that for me a little bit.
Well, I don't think it is true when we're talking about paying taxes. If you're a really low-income person, it's likely in Canada with our progressive tax system that you don't pay tax. And so in a sense, then you're looking at a middle income or even higher incomes who would get a tax cut as a result. There's a current inequity in the tax system today. And the inequity is this, that if your family uses daycare, you can get a tax credit, but if your family asks an aunt or a grandmother or a grandfather to care for children, you don't get a tax credit. Basically, that's an inequity that is not something that only wealthy families experience. One might argue that it's wealthier families who are using daycares more often. That also has a cost associated with it and oftentimes means that both parents are bringing in higher salaries. So that's really one of the misnomers, is that it only benefits wealthy families. So we can talk about numbers. We did crunch some numbers in a report we released, and we wanted to look at middle-class Canadians and some of the potential tax savings. So, for example, if you are a crane operator in Alberta with an annual salary of about $58,000, if income splitting were to be implemented, you could save close to 20% on your tax bill. So that's about $1,200, which I think some of the people who don't like family taxation, they don't like the concept, they poo-poo, that's not a lot of money. But to other people who, you know, if you ask your average family what would you do with an extra $1,200, that's actually good money to the average person. So basically, I think that that's a bit of a smear tactic to say that this only benefits the wealthy. The other thing I'll add before we move on is that there are many different ways of implementing this tax policy, and so it could be implemented well or it could be implemented poorly. And so if it's implemented poorly, they might say you can only transfer a small amount of money between spouses or somehow make it too small a group so that not many families benefit. You know, there's a good way to implement policy and a bad way, but ultimately, we know that shifting to a new form of taxation would be a step in the right direction and would overcome the inequities that I've mentioned already here. The fact that if you make your family care work in a way that doesn't engage an outside provider, you're being penalized for that choice, which arguably is just insane. It doesn't make any sense.
There were some other criticisms of this concept as well, beyond the fact that it just benefits the wealthy. Could you briefly run through some of those and talk about your rebuttal to them?
Yeah, there were tons of myths. I think my favorite one is the idea that implementing this tax policy is denigrating to women. That's one that's come up, and I find it particularly interesting because, of course, those who say that this is somehow denigrating to women, they automatically assume that no dad has ever stayed home with his kids. I'm aware of lots of families who have a mom and a dad both working part-time, for example. They go to great lengths to make sure their shifts don't happen at the same time so that a mom or a dad is home with their kids at any given time. So really, this is a family-friendly policy that allows families legally to do what they're already doing, and that is working as a family, doing a budget as a family. That's why this is tax policy that makes sense. And when opponents come out and say that somehow this is in some way denigrating to women, it'll force women to stay home, the thing I find frustrating about that is that it assumes women have no brains, that they couldn't make a choice that was good for their families. Basically, it's a way of saying we don't like the choices women do make when they receive extra money. For example, if a woman decided to stay home and that was her choice, you'd have a certain feminist mentality that would say that's not worthwhile. Family taxation actually recognizes the importance of work in the home and recognizes that it's valuable and it contributes. And so that myth really bugs me a lot because it's the opposite. You know, it doesn't denigrate women. It lifts them up. It allows them more choices, allows them more money to make more choices.
And, you know, at root, I have to wonder if there is something else going on in terms of the criticism, because primarily, you know, your two-income families working part-time notwithstanding. I think we're talking here primarily, in terms of the benefits, about the notion of one-income families. One partner, usually the mom, stays home to look after the kids. Dad goes off to work. That's a concept that's not terribly popular in some sectors of Canadian society. You mentioned the feminists. I mean, there's a whole sort of philosophical battle against that traditional model. Is this really what this criticism is about, rather than, you know, mundane tax policy?
Well, it's very true that many feminists out there who have a overrepresentation in the public square would hold the traditional family in disdain. They won't come out and say that, of course, but at bottom, they really don't like that model. Some of them may even be so extreme as to think of marriage as a form of bondage in itself, slavery, if you look at some of the feminist writing. So that's not everybody, but there is that thinking out there. And yeah, I mean, again, it's really about greater freedom. I don't know how else to put this. Income splitting allows people to keep more of their own money. If, for example, extreme feminists don't like what families do when they get to keep more of their own money, then it's a great irony that they would somehow try and couch that in terms of it forcing women to stay home or a form of slavery or what have you. It's really rich of them to suggest that that's the reality, and I think you're right to point out the ideological basis for that critique, and I will in turn point out that it's simply not fair and it does not hold water. Because people who have more money in their pockets are able to make better and more choices, not fewer. It simply amounts to them thinking that the choice that some mothers make isn't the right one. And so I think you're right to point out the ideological basis, and we are all right to inform ourselves and then counter it appropriately because it's not true.
Are the critics being elitist? I mean, I don't even like the word, but I guess it's another way of asking, is there support for this among sort of rank and file Canadians, whether or not they would personally benefit from this tax cut?
I don't mind the word elitist. I think there is some elite tendencies out there to look down upon rank and file Canadians, as you put it. And I do think there's great support for this, whether people benefit from it or not. So we cite a poll in the paper, and it shows that there's a great majority of Canadians who believe that family taxation makes sense, whether or not they benefit from it. 57%, close to 60%, think that it's a good idea. 22% were against it, and then 20% were undecided. And I think the undecided high percentage there speaks to the fact that people may not understand fully what income splitting is. But there is support for it. Of course, there's also legitimate critiques, and that's something we address in the paper as well. We don't need to look at extreme feminists or any kind of radical viewpoint. Some people are concerned about the tax code becoming too complicated. That's not my concern right now. I think my greater concern is for parents to be paying lower taxes, but we do address the fact that, in effect, a flat tax, which Alberta has on the provincial level, would address the same inequity that family taxation would address. So there's some legitimate critique of family taxation, if you could put it that way. It's just that I think at this time we're unlikely to get any kind of flat tax, so we might as well be realistic about what we can achieve for families.
So where is this issue right now politically? I mean, in the last election, the Conservatives promised to do this if they can get the budget balanced. They're apparently getting close to that balanced budget now, but there's been some suggestion lately they might back away from the promise they made in the election. I guess it's another way of asking, what's the chances of this actually happening in next year's budget in the run-up to the federal election in 2015?
I think it's highly likely there will be some form of tax relief for middle-class families. Whether or not it's the full family taxation is up for grabs. And it wouldn't hurt for your listeners to inform themselves about the issue and be aware of the process on Parliament Hill here. Pre-budget consultations happen in the fall now, October, November. I believe they even move across the country there, and then the budget comes down at some point in the spring, I think March. So, you know, I do personally believe we will see some form of tax relief, but this kind of prognosticating is perhaps not my strong suit. Hopeful that we'll see some tax relief for families, because that was part of the promise that the Conservatives made, and I think they'll stick to it in some capacity, whether they bring in a full form of family taxation or not.
So the bottom line is, lobby your MP.
Well, I don't ever advocate lobbying. We are not a lobby group, but you could tell your ARPA supporters to do that.
Andrea, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
This has been Lighthouse News, shining the light of biblical truth on today's current events. Production Manager, Mark Penninga. Technical Director, Nate Bosher. Questions or feedback, email info@arpacanada.ca. Be sure to join us again next month for another edition of Lighthouse News.